been moving straight through the Old Testament. So we finished the Pentateuch, and now we're starting into, I guess this is the first book of history in the Bible. Before we get started, I'm going to ask Tony, if he will, to lead us in a word of prayer.
Sure, pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this time that you have provided for us to come together and to study the fourth of your word. Dear Lord, pray that you'll be with us as we enter into this period of study. Help us to draw our minds in from whatever cares and concerns we may have and focus on thoughts that John shared with us tonight. Help us all to be attentive listeners and pray to be with John and helping him to in his sharing of what he has studied and prepared for us out of Joshua and Judges tonight. Please forgive us and trust him.
Amen. Like I said, we're going to study the books of Joshua and Judges this quarter. My plan is to spend an introductory class on Joshua, and then when we come to Judges, spend an introductory class on that. And then we have 10 class periods, so there will be four actual classes on the book itself after the introduction and just kind of an overview. I think it's very important that we understand the time that these books were written in, the principal characters of the book, and the situation that that the children of Israel were in, both among themselves and with regard to the other nations and tribes that they interact with. I think that will help us to understand better a little bit of the mindset of the Israelites, considering that there's quite a bit of difference between 21st century Christianity and 1400s BC, whatever it turns out. I've got it written down here somewhere. There's quite a bit of difference in the culture, in the customs, the mindset. So I like to, when I'm studying any book of the Bible, I like to try to put myself in their shoes in order to get a better feel for the situation. The books themselves, Joshua covers a period of 30 years, the last 30 years or so of Joshua's life. The book of Judges covers a period of 300 years. So we're trying to cram all that into 10 weeks, so it's going to be a little difficult. My plan for the lessons is to start with an introductory overview and then move into the books themselves. Since this is an adult class and since both the books cover a fairly lengthy amount of time and are fairly lengthy themselves, I'm not going to be doing a verse-by-verse study. It's going to be more of my plan is to spend the first 10-15 minutes of the classes just kind of a quick recap of the sections that will be assigned, and then the rest of the time I hope to have a lively question and answer period, especially concerning how these books, how the situations that we read about pertain to us as modern-day Christians, and try to talk about some of the questions that we run up against in the books. Now, some of you have had classes with me before, and you know that what I plan and reality don't always. But that's the way I'm going to try and do it. Is 10 to 15 minutes of just discussing and recapping what we're supposed to read, and then questions, and hopefully you guys will jump right in and ask questions of your own or give your opinions. It's really supposed to be kind of a give and take type class rather than just Joshua did this on such and such a date at such and such a place and that kind of thing. And I hope we get more out of it as far as our personal Christianity is concerned than we would if we were just reading about things that happened 2,000-3,000 years ago. So anyway, we'll start with the book of Joshua. We assume that Joshua is the writer of the book, although some authorities say that there was also some help compiling the different stories with another author that most of them think was Phinehas, who was the son of Eleazar, who was the son of Aaron, I believe. Who was the high priest of Israel during Joshua's leadership time. I keep wanting to say Joshua's reign, but that it wasn't really a nation yet. It wasn't really a kingdom. It was more of just a collection of tribes, and he was kind of the leader. But if I do say king or Joshua's reign, or just play along with me. So first, let's look at Joshua and who he was. We know that Joshua was very close to Moses from the time they left Egypt until the start of the book. He was kind of one of Moses's ministers. One of his lieutenants, he was I guess a general, because he led the Israelites into some battles. One of the main ones that comes to mind is the battle against the Amalekites in Exodus chapter 17. That most of us are probably familiar with, where Moses had to hold his hands up, and if he let them down, then the Israelites started to lose, and as long as he had them up, they were winning the battle. So anyway, Joshua was leading that battle, leading the Israelites in that battle. He was chosen as one of the 12 spies that went into Canaan back in Numbers, chapters, looks like 13 and 14. And most of us are familiar with this story, where he and Caleb were the only ones to come back and give a favorable report on the situation, that yes, the Israelites could take the land. And as a result of this, the doubting of the 10 spies and most of the rest of the congregation, God made Israel to wander in the wilderness for the next 40 years or so. And he and Caleb were actually the only ones of that number that were allowed to go into the promised land. Afterwards, because of their faith in God, that that they could subdue the land. Joshua's original name in Numbers 13 and verse 8 was Oshea, and that means salvation. And then in verse 16, Moses changed his name to Yehoshua, anyway, which is translated as Yahweh is salvation, or Jehovah is salvation. He was called Joshua, which is a shortened form of Yehoshua. And Joshua is the Hebrew version of that God is salvation or God is deliverance. And then the Greek version is Jesus. So just as today, when I travel south of the border, I'm Juan, or Sean in Ireland, or Ivan in Russia. It's just a matter of translation into a different language is the only difference between Jesus and Joshua. And actually, I believe in the book of Acts, chapter 7, there is a listing of Moses, David, and others, and it says Jesus in there, but it's actually referring to Joshua. So that's just an interesting little side note. Joshua was chosen to succeed Moses as the leader of the children of Israel. He was chosen by God. I'm assuming that Moses went along, but he was chosen by God to be the successor to Moses. And he was given several commands. He was commanded to lead the Israelites into Canaan. He was commanded to conquer the cities and drive out the Canaanites. He was commanded to divide the land as an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. And these are actually the main divisions in the book. If you will look in your outlines, the different sections that we're going to be doing. One is the entrance into the land, then the conquest of the land, then the division, and then finally we're going to do a section on Joshua's last speech and his death in the last, I think, two chapters. So, and those will be one class period per each one of those sections. In chapter 24, verse 29, Joshua died at the age of 110. So he had been the leader of Israel since he was about 80 years old, about 30 years. He was buried in part of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah, and from Joshua 24, verse 31. We learn his legacy. If someone could turn to Joshua 24, verse 31, and read that for us.
Israel served all the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders of Joshua, and all the works of the Lord. The bones of Joshua, the bones of Joseph, the Israelites, had brought up and buried them at the shelter. And the portion of ground that David had brought from the children of Israel,
Okay, so we see that that his legacy was that Israel served the Lord all of his days. So I guess we can say that he was a pretty good leader if Israel, which as we know is notoriously fickle concerning the Lord, actually buckled down and served him for the entire time of Joshua's leadership. The time span of the book, as I said before, is about 30 years from the time that they're preparing to enter the land of Canaan until the death of Joshua. And this, depending on who you're reading, comes between about 1234 BC to about 1211 or 10 or so. Some other people date the book from 1407 BC to 1377 BC. So that's a couple hundred years almost of difference. So the exact time is very hard to pin down. We know the time span, but the actual time just depends on where they start from and what all they're including. But in any case, it's over 3,000 years ago. So, like I said, it's difficult for modern Christians to put themselves in the shoes of the Israelites. So we have to make an effort to do that. The timeline of the book, using these first dates, in 1234 BC, the first 10 or so chapters takes place within 1 year. So we have in chapters 1 and 2 is the preparation. Joshua prepares to go into the land of Canaan. He sends spies to gather information about Jericho, which is the first city that they're going to attack. They are assisted by Rahab when they go in, and in return they promise to keep her safe when the invasion, when they do go in. In chapters 3, 4, and 5, we see them actually crossing over the Jordan River. The normal routine was for the Kohathites to carry the Ark of the Covenant, but Joshua told the Levites, the priests, to carry it, and when their feet start to touch the water, it parts, very similar to the parting of the Red Sea. There's I'm not going to talk about it tonight, but in future classes, there's maybe 8 or 10 very, very similar situations between Moses and Joshua as far as miracles are concerned and different events that are just very similar. And this parting of the Jordan River and the parting of the Red Sea, we can see some of that. In chapters 6 through 8, the Israelites start to attack Jericho, and we all know the story and the circling and the walls come tumbling down. I was going to sing the little song, but I'm not going to do it. but anyway, and then in chapters 9 and 10, Joshua, as the military commander, starts staging all these different raids against some of the major cities in the southern part of Canaan. and he's victorious pretty much every time. There is some exception, but we'll discuss that when we come to it. But he's very successful, and actually the kings in northern Canaan come together and form a coalition to try and stop the Israelites. Chapters 11 through 14 pretty much cover the rest of the campaign against the Canaanites. It's about 6 or 7 years worth of war, and I think I don't remember where I wrote it down, but there's three major campaigns during that time against about 30 different armies, and for the entire struggle to bring Canaan under control, and several of these are cataloged in chapters 11 through 14. Then in chapters 15 through 17, we read an account of Othniel, and he makes an attack on a city called Debir, and in doing so, wins the hand of Caleb's daughter. Now, Othniel is kind of important, but not so important here as he will be in Judges, because he's a judge in later years and serves about 40 years. So in 1228 BC, after the end of the conflict, in chapters 18 through 21, Joshua appoints a commission of 21 men to survey the land the land that hasn't already been given to Manasseh and Ephraim and who was the other one? Anyway, on the other side of Jordan, the two and a half tribes. He appoints a commission of 21 men to survey the land, and he then, using that survey, divides up the land by lot, and that is significant in that the tradition at that time was that anything you did by lot was controlled by God, because it was just by chance. Anyway, he divides up the land and has each of the tribes take their proper inheritance, and then he rules from that time in 1228 till about 1211 BC, and chapters 22 through the end of the book they're mostly his final request, his final speech to the Israelites, and then the story of his death. He dies without specifically naming a successor, and it's been suggested that may be a contributing factor to the turmoil that results in Judges, where the cycle of the Israelites forgetting God and then somebody invading and causing them trouble, and then they cry out to God and he appoints a judge and takes care of everything, and they come back to God for a little while, and then it starts all over again. But we'll talk about that when we study Judges. The theme of the book is essentially how victory is through faith. Joshua, the book shows that God is faithful in His promises. He promised almost 500 years prior. He promised Abraham that this particular land would be an inheritance for his seed, and it took a while, but God was faithful, and he gave them the land. First, he had to. First, he had to test them and try them. So they spent several hundred years in Egyptian bondage, and then 40 years wandering. But if we look carefully, and I'd like to see a study of this sometime, if we look carefully, we can see that each one of those trials actually benefited them when it came to inheriting the land and conquering the land. You can think of the wandering as a 40-year boot camp, or you know, whatever you want. It's God's way of ensuring that the people were ready to inherit to claim their inheritance. The book also is, as I said, the first book of history. We know that the Bible is divided into the Pentateuch and the history and the poetry and prophecy, and I used to know all of this stuff. But this is the link between Abraham and Moses and their time and Israel as a nation. Essentially, before this, Israel and all of there are very few nations in the world at that time, Egypt and a few others. Most of the people are organized into small tribes, individual cities, and smaller units, and Israel, in order to be a nation, has to take the 12 tribes and unify them, and make them a cohesive nation. And I think that's a lot of what God had intended by putting them through the trials of bondage and the subsequent wandering and having to form an army. And it was he was trying to bring them together as a nation. But we'll talk about this more as we go along. Here it is. The victory of faith. There's three military campaigns, 30 enemy armies, and the Israelites learn that their victory is coming through their faith in God and their obedience to God, and not through any kind of military superior strategies or numerical superiority or any of those things. It's directly God's doing. We see a couple of times where God actually tells them that there's too many people, set some aside and go in with a smaller force in order to show them that He is in charge, and it's His power that is doing all this, and nothing that the Israelites are doing on their own. And the book also with the story of the dividing of the land for the inheritance is it links the promise of the land, God's promise, to the actual realization of that promise, which reinforces the fact that God does follow through on His promises. He doesn't forget or any of these things. Even though we could justifiably say that the Israelites weren't really, deserving of that fulfillment, especially in the way that they treated God and disobeyed and did many bad things. But God still came through in the end. Okay, that's a quick overview. I think most of you have the outline that we passed out. Like I said, the next class next Wednesday, we'll be studying the entrance into the land, which goes from the beginning of the book to chapter 5 and verse 12. And like I said, if y'all could read that, and then I'll start off with a recap, and then we can move into questions. One thing I wanted to look at was some of the situation that the Israelites were going into as far as the battles and some of the other tribes that were involved in this situation. The Israelites in order to receive their inheritance, there were two things that were required of them. They had to overcome and defeat, if not destroy, the nations that were already in or near the promised land. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. And the second thing they had to do was they had to learn to live with... There were a few groups of people that God told them not to, specifically not to destroy and not to attack. And they had to learn to live with those groups. The Ammonites was one group that they were not to attack. Does anyone know who the Ammonites were? They were descendants of Ben Ammi, who was Lot's son through his youngest daughter. We know the story of Lot and all that. So, along with them were the Moabites, who were also descendants of Lot through his eldest daughter. I didn't get a chance to do my maps or anything, but I'll do that for next time. Or maybe get Mark to do them. He's good at that stuff. The Ammonites and the Moabites were both on the eastern side of Jordan. The Israelites had to march through there, but without fighting with them. So that was a kind of a delicate situation. that they had to work through. The Ammonites were essentially pagans. Just about everybody in Canaan were pagans. Their god was Molech, and he required human sacrifice. So even though they may have been related a ways back, they weren't really that close. The Edomites. Who were the Edomites? They were the descendants of Esau. Edom means red, so they assume that Esau had red hair, and that he was. That's where the name came from. And they were. They lived around Mount Seir, which was the area that God gave to Esau to live in. So they had their own land of promise that God had promised. And they were also, the Israelites were also commanded by God not to cause any trouble to the Edomites in Deuteronomy 2, the first 8 verses. The children of Moab also were pagans. Their god was called Chemosh, and also required the human sacrifices. So those three were on the eastern side of Jordan, as you come into Canaan. I'm probably doing this wrong, but anyway. They were not to have caused any trouble with them. There were, however, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, there were 7 nations or tribes that they were told to remove, destroy, whatever. These were the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And God promised that He would deliver these people into the hands of the nation of Israel. And it says, once the 7 nations were defeated, the Israelites were to put them all to death. Do not make an alliance with them or show them any mercy. That didn't work out so well, but that was the original command from God. The Hittites were looks like a major power and an empire at the time when Joshua led the Israelites into the land. They first appeared in the Bible when members of the tribe sold Abraham some land as a burial plot for his wife Sarah, which is Genesis chapter 23. The Canaanites are descended from Canaan, who was the son of Ham, one of Noah's children, which I found maybe a little odd in that Lot and his descendants, they weren't to touch them. They were considered brethren. But the descendants of Noah, specifically through Ham, it was okay to wipe them out. That's one of the things that we'll try and discuss in a further class about the differences between modern Christianity and the religion back then, and how we can reconcile all of these seemingly harsh punishments with our concept of not exactly live and let live, but you don't kill someone just because they don't believe the same. Anyway, we'll talk about that at a later time, and hopefully we can get everything hashed out here. The Girgashites, I couldn't find anything on them, so I can't tell you anything about them. The Amorites were also descended from Canaan, and supposedly were giants. I think King Sihon was one of the was one of the Amorites, and they lived just to the east of the Dead Sea. But they actually, the Israelites conquered them. Yes, in Numbers 21, it says that under Moses they destroyed the tribe and took all of their cities, including Heshbon. But then after that, there's nothing really mentioned about the Amorites in the Bible. The Hivites lived mostly around the area of Shechem. The Jebusites lived in and around the city of Jebus. Does anyone know what Jebus? That's Jerusalem. So a lot of this stuff you have to kind of know that, and I'm thinking it must be a tradition in the Middle East going way back that everybody has at least two names, and different people are called different things, different towns are called different things, or it may just be that if the city was Jebus in 1400 BC and became Jerusalem hundreds of years later. Anyway, we will continue this next week. Please read the from the beginning of the book to chapter 5, verse 12, the entrance into the land, for next week, and we'll try to go over. We'll try to get through most of it. Thank you.